Blog Talk Radio.
Special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
On the Boxing Source Radio Show, and this is the March 10th, 2019 edition of the podcast. I am your host, James Bell. I am the leading boxing analyst for the cohort Truth on Sports, sports blog, covering boxing, golf, football, basketball, and more. You can catch articles at thechtonsports.com. Number to dial in to get in on the boxing talk is 347-237-5539. Once again, 347-237-5539. You can press 1 to get on cue. You'll be able to talk live on the show, or we got like about 1 hour live session here that we're going to be covering a few things. Within the sport, a couple of major stories. Of course, you have the fights that were, over in California and in New York yesterday. So we're going to be going through those major fights, which included Sean Porter, Yanez Ugas. You had Maurice Hooker against Mikel Lespierre, and you did have Demetrius Bivol taking on Joe Smith Jr. So we're going to be going through those three fights. And then also have a look ahead to the major fight that's coming up on March 16th in the AT&T Stadium between Errol Spence Jr. and Mikey Garcia. So we're going to be getting right into it here. Just wanted to start off with the fights that were on Fox yesterday. You had Premier Boxing Champions on Fox, where the main event had Sean Porter defending the WBC title against Yanez Ugas. You had Sean Porter in there with his first defense of that WBC title after he won it back in September last year by decision over Danny Garcia. And you had Yanez Ugas there as his opponent, someone who was like a top contender there in the welterweight division. He did have a high ranking within the IBF rankings, which you had Errol Spence Jr. as the current title holder for that. But Yanez Ugas, opted to go ahead and fight for the WBC title. And, that's why he kind of like campaigned, was part of the undercard for that Sean Porter Danny Garcia fight. Ended up winning that matchup to, set himself up for his fight here against Sean Porter. Sean Porter, of course, like I said, had, his shot, I would say, of trying to be among the top guys there in the welterweight division. He did, like I said, win that IBF title, but ended up losing to Kell Brook after defending it one time against Paulie Malignaggi. Then had another opportunity of winning a world title against Keith Thurman in 2016. It was a very close fight. Probably was a back and forth fight, one of the best fights of 2016 in my opinion. But Thurman got the unanimous decision on that. But Porter, stayed within, contention and just kept winning fights until he was put into that position against Danny Garcia last year to win that WBC welterweight title that, was vacated by Keith Thurman after Keith Thurman beat Danny Garcia for that WBC title. So now he had his first defense against Jordanus Ugas. Ugas' first shot at a world title. You know, a guy that, you know, has height, length, you know, kind of like seemed like a fighter that, you know, people were saying is a quote-unquote avoided fighter. You know, of course, has a, you know, a Cuban background, and, you know, how you had a lot of those, you know, a lot of these fighters that have Cuban backgrounds that, you know, they say that those guys are like avoided, but it's like, you know, a lot of people or a lot of fans may not have enough interest or enough backing to support fighters like Ugas and among others. Of course, you know about Luis Ortiz, and you know about Guillermo Rigondeaux, and of course you had Arislandi Lara out there. So, you know, Ugas is another one of those fighters that falls into that, you know, that line of, you know, Cuban fighters. So he was able to, you know, eventually get his shot here at a world title against Sean Porter. You know, and I kind of like say that here, this was something for me to like see where both of those fighters are. You know, Sean Porter, you know, said that he wanted to get himself in the ring and try to prove that he is among the top guys in the welterweight division, that he, you know, wanted to see himself fighting Errol Spence in the near future. He pretty much hinted at that after he got that win over Danny Garcia last year. So, you know, this was, you know, a fight to like kind of like say, okay, I'm going up against this guy. This is his first shot at a, you know, world title. I've been in multiple world title fights. And so, you know, seeing if he could go out there and impress people and say that, okay, he's, you know, a valid opponent for, you know, like Errol Spence. If Errol Spence gets through his fight that's on this coming Saturday, which we'll go over later in this podcast. But, you know, I was looking at what we were seeing here in those first few rounds between Sean Porter and Jordanus Ugas, and it kind of like looked like both fighters were very tentative in what they wanted to do or were trying to do in this particular fight. You had Jordanus Ugas. Like I was saying, he's a taller fighter. He looked like he was a rangier fighter. But he kind of like models or has his strategy as being a counterpuncher. So he basically was waiting on Sean Porter to do something before he was going to, you know, before he was going to start throwing. And, you know, while that kind of like seems fairly good, Porter was somebody there that, you know, who as a shorter fighter, he kind of like tried to stay away from the length or reach of Jordanus Ugas, assuming that Ugas was going to come in with a jab instead of going through with that counterpunching ability. So, you know, what we had in this particular fight was a lot of posturing, a lot of standing around, a lot of feigning, a lot of baiting by both fighters. And it was mainly something to where you had to have Sean Porter be the guy that, you know, goes first or throws first before Jordanus Ugas even responded. And it seemed like Ugas had a strategy in place where, you know, he wanted to, you know, I'd say, tried to, like, get into the inside like he usually does. But he didn't, like, you know, kind of, like, throw any punches first to, like, try to get into the inside. He tried to get himself in range first before he tried to get into the inner side of Jordanus Ugas. And as a response, Ugas would, you know, throw punches to Sean Porter's body and, you know, try to work off of that. Seemed like Ugas was, you know, fairly successful with those punches to the body. You know, a few of them were landing, a few of them were, you know, getting blocked by Sean Porter, but it seemed like what he was doing seemed to have a little bit of effect on Sean Porter. I mean, for me, you know, I kind of like went in there expecting for Jordanus Ugas to kind of like take the, you know, take the fight to Sean Porter and make Sean Porter try to do something first, or actually have Sean Porter react to what Ugas is doing. But Ugas seemed to be content in trying to be the guy that was second. And, you know, while it was, you know, while he was connecting, he was kind of like gaining confidence in those, you know, first four or five rounds or so. And it looked like, you know, he would be, you know, in the lead. But, you know, sometimes it's more about like how you take it to the champion instead of how you react to the champion. And the thing about it was that, you know, Porter just, you know, stayed calm and, you know, pretty much wanted to do his own thing there in the ring. And he eventually became more successful with his inside game. You know, I would say starting around the sixth round or so, he, you know, I would say, you know, started to land a little bit more with his combinations. He started to throw more combinations later on during the fight, and you kind of like seen that. One of the things that, you know, I saw here in this particular telecast with the PBC on Fox, you see how they kind of like incorporate, you know, stats while the action is going on. And, you know, what they had was they had a punch count or a punch landing count during the course of this fight. And, you know, at first you seen that you had Jordanus Ugas landing more total shots than Sean Porter within those first four or five rounds or so. But later on, as things started to pick up, you had Porter increasing his activity, and with him increasing his activity, the punches landed seemed to be more and more in his favor as he got to round six, round seven, round eight. And, you know, with that, you kind of like seen Porter pick up his activity, but Ugas was, you know, still content on, you know, kind of like doing his one-punch counters to the body. And then later on, around like round nine to round 10, he kind of like mixed those up and started to throw to the head of Sean Porter and try to, you know, affect things a little bit more there. So, you know, we kind of like mix things up, but he still didn't like look like he was very confident in trying to go all out against Sean Porter, which, you know, I think should be one thing that opponents of Sean Porter should do against him is, you know, try to also press the action and see how, you know, see how he reacts to that. In the second half of the fight, you also saw like a little bit more, I would say, phone booth style action between those two fighters. And I thought that, you know, it would be something to more of Porter's advantage because, you know, he was a shorter fighter. He, you know, likes to work on the inside, likes to work, you know, down low and then come back up. And I think, you know, that kind of like got him to be got him to get back into the particular fight. So, you know, that's something that, you know, I kind of like seeing there and what I was kind of like watching out for. You know, I would say like within the 10th and 11th round, you kind of like seen signs of Ugas, for me, kind of like showed a few signs like he had won the fight pretty much around the 10th round or so, and kind of, you know, didn't necessarily press the action as much as he should have to kind of like finish things off. And, you know, there was like, you know, in the 11th round, near the end of the 11th round, Ugas was coming towards Porter while Porter was backing up. And then Porter, like, threw a jab right when Ugas was coming forward and did follow up with the right hand. But that left hand that Porter threw got Ugas to be off balance, and he stumbled a little bit. And, you know, I kind of, like, felt that, you know, moments like that kind of, like, took the round for Sean Porter, particularly in those, you know, last few rounds, like in the 10th, like I say, about the 9th, 10th, or, you know, 11th round, all of those rounds were like rounds where you kind of like seen either fighter could have done, you know, something to like press the action, but you just saw a lot of standing and watching and, you know, posturing and all that type of stuff. You know, when those rounds were pretty much in most of the fight. But all it would have took was like one or two clean punches by either fighter to kind of like give them the advantage in that particular round. And so, you know, going into the last round, you had a couple of instances where those guys were getting tied up close. There was, you know, instance where, you know, Porter was, you know, down, and it was ruled as a slip. But, you know, the thing about it is that you kind of like seen where, you know, both fighters didn't do really much to kind of like convincingly finish the fight. And it did go to the scorecards, and, you know, I felt that it was very close, but you had the scorecards on 116-112 for Sean Porter, 117-111 for Yadenis Ugas, and 115-113 for Sean Porter. So Porter ends up retaining the WBC title there. And, you know, you had one judge give him 7 rounds, the other judge give him 8 rounds, and one judge gave Ugas 9 rounds, 3 for Ugas. So that's what we had there. In this particular matchup. Before I, like, go further with those scores and everything, you got 646 on the line. You're on the Boxing Source radio show.
Hey, what's good, JR? This is Matt, man. I heard you talking about the Porter-Ugas fight. Honestly, the scores are the scores. Every round was a toss-up round for me. You could have scored it either way. If it would have been 120-108 for one fighter over the other, I wouldn't argue with that either, because each round was close. The judges literally could have gave each round to every guy. I did see Ugas say he thought he won the fight. He has every right to feel that way. The fight was that close. The rounds were that much of a toss-up. Is a rematch warranted? Not really. You survive in advance. The fight wasn't so exciting where you're going to see a groundswell of support for a rematch. And the decision wasn't really controversial at all. You know, the fight really could have went either way. I just want to see what Porter does from here on out. I heard that he called out Pacquiao, Spence, and Thurman. We'll see if he sticks to that, or we'll see, you know, if he just keeps treading water, basically. You know, this new style that he has is It won him the fight, but it really could have lost him that he should have went back to his old style of mauling and pressuring, because that's really what was winning him rounds. You saw in the middle rounds when he started really taking it to Ugas and getting inside Ugas' range and really working him over, that's when Porter was at his best. But he was content to box from the outside for some reason. I don't know if he's trying to extend his career or show that he can box. I don't know what it is, but to me, the way he's won his last two fights is a very dangerous way for him going forward, because he's going to end up on the wrong end of one of these decisions.
Yeah, he did incorporate this style in that Danny Garcia fight. He did kind of like seeing some elements of his mauling style in that Danny Garcia fight, but in that second half of the fight, he kind of like, you know, switched things up a little bit and then, you know, just did that in order for him to get that decision. But here from like the beginning, he just felt like he just wanted to box Yordanis Ugas. And, you know, like I was saying, you know, at the opening, Ugas is, you know, a taller fighter that had, you know, more range. If, you know, Ugas had any sense of throwing a jab first, you know, he could have, you know, clearly, you know, had the lead going into those first few rounds or so. You know, you were saying, like, every round could have been scored for either fighter, mainly because, you know, there was a lot of posturing by both guys. You didn't see anybody that was really content or, you know, set on being the first guy to throw a punch. It was like, you know, they were waiting for the other guy to do something first. And I'm like, you can't really, you know, do that in a fight like of this magnitude where a world title is on the line, especially if you're a challenger. You got to, you know, sometimes take it to the champion, you know, especially if you feel like you're, you know, better than the champion is, then you just take it to him. Why wait for the champion to do something to you if you feel that you're better than he is, you know? So, I mean, many of those, you know, first four rounds or so was something that, you know, Ugas could have really done something in order to, you know, have Porter, you know, kind of like change his game probably a little bit earlier or try to get to using that, you know, bull style or whatever it is that, you know, Porter used to do, you know, a lot earlier and then try to, you know, counter off of that. But Ugas just really didn't do that. And I guess he just felt that he was, you know, absolutely content on, you know, what he was doing, just waiting on the whole thing about, you know, doing counters and whatnot.
Yeah, that's really accurate what you said there. But my question to you on Ugas, do you think he deserves a rematch with Porter?
Not really. For me, I mean, I just felt that he didn't do enough to kind of like say, okay, he really took the fight to Porter, that, you know, he kind of was, he like made a complete effort to try to win the title from Porter. I thought he had his opportunities, but he just didn't take advantage of them. So I just don't see where, you know, a rematch could, you know, where would warrant him a rematch of any sort. I mean, you know, it's not like he was, you know, rated as a top guy in the WBC rankings anyway. This was like a voluntary defense against somebody that was, you know, below the top five in the WBC rankings there. So, you know, with him having, you know, while it was a close fight, it wasn't like something that said, oh, wow, man, you know, I can't wait to, you know, see this fight again. It, you know, it's not like, you know, how Porter versus Thurman was. It wasn't to that level. It wasn't to the, I mean, even like Thurman Garcia wasn't like that. It wasn't like, you know, Porter Garcia was. You know, Porter Garcia was close, but it had like a lot of action.
This
particular fight did not have that.
It fell below expectations for me. I was expecting more from Porter. You know, Ugas did what he does. You know, he actually was more aggressive than I thought he would be. He was really working the body very well. I thought that was beautiful. But Porter, I don't know. I don't like his new style, JR. I really don't. It's not fun to watch, and he's going to end up getting clipped.
Yeah, he could get clipped because, I think I've seen it. You know, I've seen it actually at some point even before this fight. He tried to do it before, and he did get clipped. You know, one thing that I, bring up is, he's done the thing where he tries to, be on his feet, and bounce around the ring and that type of stuff. But he did that in the 12th round against Adrian Broner, and the first punch that was thrown put him to the canvas. He has those moments where he's like trying to bounce around like he's a boxer, but he just can't do that here, against, these top guys in the welterweight division.
Now, round 12 of the fight, you had the controversial decision made by Jack Reese. Ugas threw a punch that looked like it landed at the back of the head. Porter, quote-unquote, slipped and fell at the same time. It wasn't ruled a knockdown. Was that the correct ruling, and how much of a difference do you think that made?
Oh, man. Yeah, that was a definite judgment call. I got to look at it because it was like, it wasn't like, he was like backing up, and then you had the whole thing with the feet going on between both of those fighters. So if he had that knockdown, it would have definitely, affected the scores, they had it 116, 112. So he would have, lost that. He probably would have lost that round, and that could have, swung things over to Ugas' favor. He probably would have had that 115-113 score flipped over in his favor if he got that knockdown. So that would have been a significant change there if he was able to get that knockdown ruled for him in the 12th round. Real quick, we got on the line here, 813. You're on the Boxing Source Radio Show.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Terrell calling from Tampa, and real quick, I know you guys are talking about the Porter Ugas fight, and I'm going to just speak on it real quick. I mean, real quick, that was Ugas' fight to have, he had the height over Porter, and had the style, if he used the style better throughout that fight. But, I mean, the main point I take from that fight, there's so many times when there was like good even exchanges between the two. And Ugas clearly, I think, had the speed advantage over Porter. But there's so many times where he just simply hit him a couple of times and stared at him, like, and begged him, and just begged him to come on. I'm like, no. We notice again, you got to take the title from the champ in that regard. But stop with all this, come on, give me more. No, he has so many opportunities just to stay on the offensive and, in a sense, kind of overwhelm Porter with his boxing. Porter loves to brawl, loves to make it rough, but that was this type of fight. He had to definitely stay more on his feet, and in that regard, box more than he normally would have wanted to. So he couldn't make this fight ugly in that regard. So in a sense, mm-hmm. He's kind of lucky to come out of this fight with his title intact. And while Ugas, he can just only sit back and watch the tape again and wonder why he didn't do more to win rounds and win exchanges. He had the opportunity. He's right there in front of him the entire fight. So that really bewildered me on his decision for that game plan.
Yeah, it was, that point that you made there about, Ugas having those instances where he had chances to, take it to the champion and didn't, but was just content on just posturing and showing off to the fans and whatever it is. You can't necessarily do that if you're not, you know, being active enough against the champion. You got to, you know, throw some more punches, throw some, you know, throw some jabs in there, mix things up with Porter first. But, you know, it could have been something there. He just, like you said, he could have taken advantage and he wasn't, you know, able to do that. And, you know, while he did feel like he won the fight, it was very close. Once you have those opportunities, you know, out there for you, I don't see why you don't, you know, necessarily go for it. You know, just throw all your chips in the, you know, chips on the table and go all out. You know, you never really know, like, especially, you know, like I was saying here in reference to Ugas being, you know, having his Cuban background, you don't know when you're going to have that type of an opportunity ever again. So why not just go all out and just say, hey, I clearly beat the champion. I didn't, you know, have any instances where I just stood there and, you know, waited for Sean Porter to do something. I actually took the fight to the champion. And so, you know, there, I just think it was an opportunity squandered there for you, Dennis Ugas. And, you know, Matt was, you know, asking me if, you know, this fight kind of like warrants a rematch. And I was like, no, because you really didn't have that type of action in this fight from round one to round 12 to kind of like warrant it being a rematch. And, you know, while part of it is on Porter for doing what he was doing out there in the ring, you know, just trying to box instead of, you know, trying to maul your Dennis Ugas, it's also on Ugas because Ugas could have, you know, made it to a fight where he wanted to try to take it away from Sean Porter, but he was just, you know, content on waiting for Porter to go into the inside and then countering and then trying to get the best out of that counter that he got. Real quick, just getting in area code 205 on here.
Hey, what's going on, James? What's going on, fellas? It's Mike Brady. How y'all doing?
Doing good there, brother Mike.
I hear we talking about the Ugas and Sean Porter fight.
Yeah, just going through it, you know, Porter getting a split decision. He got like, you know, 8 rounds in his favor, one card, and 7 rounds in his favor on another card, while one judge gave 9 rounds to Ugas on this one. So what did you think about the fight?
I thought that, so you could obviously see that Sean Porter came out with a game plan. Like, they came out and they game plan to box and, as you said, not maul like he normally does. And so, like, I can see why they included that as one of the options to how to fight Ugas, because I feel like they probably thought about like the Keith Thurman fight, whereas Keith Thurman moved more. I mean, you know, Keith Thurman moved a lot more, but he used a lot of number one, like, he would lead the action while moving and then make Sean Porter have to reset. And so, at times, Sean Porter would get countered with, like, big stuff. And I think that's when he got hurt a couple times when Keith Thurman, like, countered him. So, with Ugas, you could see that Ugas had enough speed, enough I didn't really, like, pay attention to his power like that. But let's just hypothetically say enough power to keep Sean Porter honest. And I think him and his dad kind of paid attention to that, and they were like, well, you can fight this fight, and, you know, you maul him, and then he clips you a couple times, clips him, and he's just, like, touching him a couple times. And people, you know, it'd be like the Mayweather syndrome where Ugas is getting clearly the cleaner shot, but Sean Porter is just kind of, like, trying to engage, and then he's just getting hit clean because he's trying to engage. But, you know, that prompted him to fight the style that he fought in. And when he did try to, you know, close the gap, Ugas would kind of like hit him. But you know, there were times where he did land, and definitely maybe like the first two rounds, where he was more active than Ugas was. And so, like you said, Ugas didn't bring the fight per se. Like, it was a lot of interpretation for, okay, yeah, Ugas landed clean shots, but Sean Porter was kind of controlling the action. I mean, all I saw Ugas was doing was just posturing. Don't get me wrong, he definitely controlled a little bit of the action, but Sean Porter definitely, you know, like if Sean Porter didn't engage, they didn't engage. If Sean Porter didn't go to the middle of the ring or wherever he went and start throwing punches, they wouldn't engage. And Ugas was standing in the middle of the ring going like, are you going to fight? Are you going to fight? Are you going to come to me? Are you going to fight? But that's just posturing. That's like what you do glittery and stuff. But I don't know. I think Sean Porter winning is an okay decision. Again, it depends on what you like, what people like. If you like counter, then you'll probably like Ugas fighting. But I would tend to say that maybe he did not do enough to take it away in terms of him just waiting and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, my thing was, it's just, you know, a lot of posturing by your Dennis Ugas. All he had to do was just, you know, try to come forward a little bit more. Press the action for Sean Porter to do something. If you don't get the better of the exchanges up close, then, I mean, that is what it is. But you got to, you know, at least try to give yourself more opportunities to, you know, try to score something against Sean Porter. While there were some instances where Porter kind of like was, you know, out of place and, you know, missed shots, especially like from a distance, he missed a lot of shots from a distance, but you really didn't see your Dennis Ugas make a pay for missing those shots when he was out of range. So the other thing was like a lot of instances, especially in the second half of the fight, I saw Sean Porter like hit Ugas clearly with his left jab and just keep hitting him with the left jab. Bam, bam. It just, you know, kept hitting him with it. And Ugas didn't do nothing much to, like, kind of respond to that. He just, you know, stood there and then tried to, you know, get to Sean Porter, like, you know, whether he was trying to get to Sean Porter in the ropes or, you know, try to, you know, corner him or something like that instead of, you know, just doing effective moves to try to cut Porter off in the ring and then work him then. So, you know, I just felt that there were, you know, multiple chances for Yordanis Ugas to, you know, try to get to Sean Porter, but he just didn't do those. And that ended up, for me, it ended up, you know, costing him the fight there. You know, with this win, you have, you know, Sean Porter, you know, retaining that WBC title. Matt was saying that, you know, Porter was, you know, looking for trying to get, you know, fight there with, what, Thurman again, a Pacquiao. I did say, you know, right after Porter's win against Garcia that he didn't have much of an issue, or he said that he didn't have much of an issue fighting Errol Spence. If Errol Spence, you know, gets through Mikey Garcia on Saturday. So, you know, we could try to go for a unification. I'm going to just, you know, open it out for the floor. What are, like, Porter's chances against the likes of a, you know, a Pacquiao or Thurman or Spence if he fought any one of those guys? I'm going to start with Terrell first, and then I'm going to go with Matt.
Hey, just take that question again, please, Jay.
What was that?
Restate the question, please.
Like, with Sean Porter, he says that he wants to, you know, go after the likes of Manny Pacquiao or Keith Thurman next. And he has also, you know, stated that he has, you know, little issues fighting Errol Spence if that opportunity came up to him. How do you think he would fare against either one of those guys or any one of those guys?
Yeah, just Porter against Pacquiao would be interesting. Porter against Thurman is the fight I would prefer to see, given that they had that spirited fight a couple of years ago between when Thurman beat Porter, right? But just looking once again, looking at Thurman Pacquiao, so I think Porter's, what, 30-31, where Pacquiao's, what, 39-40, something like that, or whatever. So obviously Porter will come in with the age advantage. Interesting. Still an interesting fight because Pacquiao still can fight. He still can fight. So probably time has not caught up with him as of yet. It kind of would be a perfect fight for Pacquiao because Pacquiao prefers the opponent that comes to him and that he can just throw punches from different angles, things like that. But at the same time, can Porter's rough and tumble style overcome Pacquiao? And in my opinion, he could beat him. I do think he could beat him. But at this point, we've seen Pacquiao's team, in a sense, avoid certain fighters. Like he avoided Crawford, we know that, years ago. So would they put him in there with Porter, expecting that type of fight, high-energy fight, for 12 full rounds if it goes that long? So in reality, will that happen? Probably not. Probably not. I think that Thurman is probably the more likely fight that we'll probably see first out of a Porter versus Pacquiao, Thurman, or even Spence in that regard. So obviously, once again, with Porter and Thurman, the two know each other. They fought before. I don't know if Porter will even have an advantage. If you consider Porter to have an advantage over that, given Thurman's inactivity, we know he fought back in January. We know that, and we know he didn't look the best. Well, you know, you still got to give the guy time to get back into the top portion of the division. But like I said, the Thurman Porter is probably the likely fight that we could see out of those mentioned names. But would I favor Porter over Thurman? Probably would, slightly. So that's my take on that.
All right, gotcha. Next up is Matt, then we'll go to Mike Grady on it.
Honestly, before yesterday, I thought Porter would maul Pacquiao and beat Pacquiao. But looking at it now, I would still favor Pacquiao to beat Porter. I think Pacquiao is too busy for Porter. Porter only throws about, 50 to 55 punches per round. I don't think that's going to get it done against a Tasmanian devil like Manny Pacquiao. So he wants to fight, obviously, for monetary reasons. I don't blame him for that. Manny Pacquiao is a legend, and he still generates a decent amount of coin. But I don't think that that's a fight that Sean Porter would be able to win. As for Keith Thurman, we already saw Porter versus Thurman the first time. Honestly, Thurman is still much better than him. People are still harping about Thurman's return bout against Jose Cesar Lopez, but he did what he had to do in that fight. He boxed beautifully. He was able to knock Lopez down. I think that Thurman is only going to get better this year. So I think he can beat Porter also. As for Spence, listen, there's a reason why, even though Porter said he would fight Spence next, that he didn't. So until one of these guys actually steps in the ring with Spence, I'll believe it when I see it. I think Porter is about, I'd say, maybe like the fifth or sixth best welterweight. You got Spence, Thurman, Crawford, Pacquiao, and then I'd say you have Porter. So he's about number five, just ahead of Swift Garcia. That's where he's at. If he fights any of the top guys, I think he'll lose. He might not get knocked out, but I think he'll lose by like a unanimous decision, because I'm telling you, this new style that he's fighting, he's getting lucky with it, because he very well could have lost that fight last night. And if the decision would have went to Ugas, I don't think there's anyone on the planet that would have complained about that. That's how close the fight was. And if you're life and death with a guy like Ugas, who has never been a top-level fighter, then you don't want to bark up that Pacquiao, Spence, or Thurman tree.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Ugas was, you know, like I was saying last week, you know, this is a guy in Ugas that, you know, ended up losing to Amir Imam in the, you know, lower divisions. And I think he, like, took a little break, either not soon after that fight or a little bit after that fight. So, you know, someone like Ugas, you got to be able to, you know, handle business against guys like that if you feel that you could contend against, you know, Pacquiao, Thurman, and Spence. So, you know, that's what I got off of that. Mike, what do you think about Porter's chances against any of those guys?
Against Manny Pacquiao, against who, though?
Pacquiao, Thurman, and Spence.
I think in terms of like hurting people, he's the most dangerous in terms of like physically hurting people and like leaving people less than what they are before they come into the fight. I think he's the most dangerous of doing that. Pacquiao definitely beats people, but Pacquiao ain't got that killer instinct anymore. I mean, could be a byproduct of like of needles and stuff, but who knows? Yeah, Keith Thurman will win, but I think Keith Thurman is thinking about his family and stuff, and Keith Thurman will continue to fight and do what he needs just to win. You know, I don't think Keith Thurman gonna go in there and like let's brawl and then like that. I think he'll like say how can I win the fight? What's the easiest way and the least dangerous way I can win the fight? And that's how he'll win. Against Pacquiao, I can see Porter giving Pacquiao problems, but Porter would definitely have to fight the who did he headbutt, and then he knocked him out from the headbutt. The fight ended because he kept headbutting the dude.
You talking about the Berto fight?
Berto. He would have to fight Pacquiao when he fought Berto. Like, you know, like he would bust his head, you know what I'm saying? Like that's the only way I can see him winning a Pacquiao fight. But I don't think Pacquiao could contend with it, don't get me wrong, but I think it would be tougher for Pacquiao to contend getting mauled. And you know, it would just be a different – you would see if Pacquiao still wanted to see if he willing to go through that. So, yeah, I could see it being competitive if Porter mauled Pacquiao. But Thurman,
yeah, I think
I can see Thurman.
Yeah, I think that fight would be a very interesting one.
Yeah, I can see Thurman winning on like boxing, and then Spence probably just would win outright because I think Spence could out Porter.
Yo, Matt, I was kind of like surprised that you know when you brought up Spence and Porter, I thought you would bring up, you know, a barbecue chicken alert when you know you kind of like have that matchup, but
well, I think that goes without saying. Like, come on, like, listen, what Jay-Z said: do not bark up that tree; that tree will fall on you. Like, come on, man, he don't want that. The man was in the ring with Errol Spence and said, "Yeah, we'll do it next," and then what happened? So I was like, come on, man. If he really wanted to fight Spence, it would have been a great unification bout, but he doesn't want that. And I don't know why these guys pretend like they want it until it comes down to sit down and hammer out a deal. Like, I just don't get it. And then, you know, I'm starting to see the tide turn against Spence because he's fighting Garcia. Well, who is he supposed to fight? We know Aram is not going to let Crawford fight on the PBC platform. We know that both guys are going to want to get paid a ton for that fight. So who else is he supposed to fight? I don't get it, man. Let these welterweights step up and get knocked down by the truth.
Well, Looks like we're going to have to wait until later for that to happen. That's the thing with Spence is like, yeah, he got all these guys that are, you know, welterweights that got these belts and were, you know, had these high spots in the welterweight division, but when it came to fighting Errol Spence, they didn't necessarily want to do it or, you know, have the action on it. I just think that, you know, with Porter, the most intriguing fight would probably be against Manny Pacquiao because, you know, he would probably try to, you know, take the fight to Manny Pacquiao, and, you know, it would be interesting to see what Pacquiao does if he, you know, had like a counter-punching ability to do something to react to Sean Porter. But I just don't see Manny Pacquiao fighting someone like Porter, mainly because of money. Of course, they brought up the potential rematch between Pacquiao and Mayweather. So, a Pacquiao-Porter fight would be out of the card. So, you know, I kind of like to see Thurman being the candidate for Porter to fight next. Out there in the welterweight division. Here on the Boxing Source Radio Show live, if you wanted to call in, number is 347-237-5539. Wanted to get in real quick the fight card that was in Verona, New York. You had two world title fights on there. Maurice Hooker was going up against Miguel Espierre, and you had Dimitri Bivol against Joe Smith Jr. Both those guys, Bivol and Maurice Hooker, had easy victories against their opponents. With Maurice Hooker, you know, going up against Lespierre, I thought he would have been able to, you know, take out Lespierre. This was like, you know, Lespierre's first major fight, like, ever, and it was like, you know, pretty much a huge step up for Lespierre. So I thought Hooker would, you know, try to be able to, you know, beat this guy like he was able to beat Saucedo in his last fight. And I also thought that Bivol was going to be able to take out Joe Smith, but he kind of like let Joe Smith get through those 12 rounds out there for that unanimous decision. Now, I didn't, you know, I watched that fight between Bivol and Smith until the decision. I didn't see if Bivol had the same line at the end of that fight that he had at the end of this fight against against John Pascal. But it almost goes to the theory that Matt had about Dimitri Bivol and why he went over to the zone, because
he don't want it. He don't want it. Say what it is, JR. Listen, he boxes beautifully. The announcers were sucking him off. Oh, look at his balance. Look how balanced he looks. Who gives a shit how balanced he looks? That man don't like getting hit. He don't like getting hit. I'm telling you that right now. I see it. As soon as he gets caught, he's looking around like, yo, what just happened? He looks like he does not like to get hit. And I'm telling you, if he fights any of the top guys, the other champions at 175, that man is getting clipped. If he even goes down to fight Callum Smith, he is getting clipped.
Oh, yeah.
This guy cannot take a punch. He cannot take a punch. He gets rocked with glancing blows. You can't tell me this guy can take a punch. He boxes beautifully. Awesome footwork, awesome balance. He understands distance and timing. But in boxing, eventually, you're going to get hit. And when he gets hit, he no likey. Now, when he goes up against these guys like Joe Smith and a washed-up John Pascal, yeah, they're not going to be able to capitalize on it. But if he goes up against Vozdick, or a Beterbiev, or even a Sergey Kovalev, who, you know, I don't rate very highly, these guys will be able to capitalize when he gets done, and he is going to get taken out. I'm telling you that right now.
Yeah, that's the thing about Bivol is that he is really susceptible to getting caught by these, you know, big shots. And he really doesn't like when he gets caught by those big shots. So he's going to have to do something and clean up his – I say you got to clean up his defense, man. Really got to clean up his defense because it just looked like he's, you know, very straightforward, very linear, and just wants to, you know, go through the motions. And, you know, if he can't necessarily, like, walk through his opponent, he just wants to, you know, take things easy instead of pressing the action. Because in this particular fight against Joe Smith, he had a couple of chances where he could have just, you know, went ahead and tried to, you know, seriously hurt Joe Smith and put him down to the canvas, but he didn't, you know, follow through with it. So it's almost
why
like he's
he don't like
trigger happy
back at him.
You know,
yeah, he doesn't like what's coming back at him. That's why he couldn't finish Pascal, and that's why he couldn't finish Smith. And the funny part that really pissed me off, and this is what pissed me off about boxing fans, at the very end of the fight, in the last 10 seconds, Bivol let his hands go to make it seem as if, oh, he could have been doing that all fight. Listen, you can fool the fans. You're not going to fool me. We know what that is. You wanted to make it seem like you could have did that all fight, but you were gun shy, my man, because you don't like what was coming back at you. When he got clipped with that looping right hand at the end of the round and he needed the rope to walk him back to his corner, I was like, yo, this guy out here, he can't take any type of shot. Now, I know Joe Smith has power, but Joe Smith ain't no killer. You know, this guy's living off of knocking a 50-year-old Bernard Hopkins out of the ring. I still say he tripped. But anyway, you know, this guy is living off of that, and they make it seem like he's some sort of killer at 175, and this is some great victory. Bivol, oh, he was an amazing performance. No. I have not been impressed with Dmitry Bivol, and no one's going to force me to be depressed to Dmitry Bivol. Let him fight one of the other champions, please. Let's see what this kid really got. Because to me, right now, he is hiding on the zone. Straight up hiding.
Yeah, and you know, the thing with Joe Smith, and you had that fight against Bernard Hopkins, and then, you know, he turns right around and he has that, you know, the fight against Sullivan Barrera, right? And the thing about that one was, like, that could have been, you know, his opportunity to try to step up and get himself in position to contend for, like, heavyweight title early, you know, than he has right now. And he just could not do anything much at all against Sullivan Barrera and lost a unanimous decision after, you know, getting that knockdown in the first round. So it's like, man, if you couldn't take advantage then there was no way that you were going to be able to, you know, try to do something now against, you know, likes of Dmitry Bivol. But at the same token, Bivol, you know, should have been able to just, you know, walk right through someone like Joe Smith if he can't, you know, handle somebody, you know, like a Sullivan Barrera right there. Mike Grady, what was your take? What was your take on the fight?
I didn't watch the fight fully. I only watched, like, literally seconds of the fight, like a couple seconds here, a couple seconds there. So I can't speak on it. But from what you guys are saying, Bivol was getting hit clean. Question mark.
Hey, Terrell, what do you think about Bivol's performance?
Yeah, I tell you what. Me personally, I was picking Smith to win this fight, and I thought that he's going to be able to somehow hurt Bivol. And because, like you guys are alluding to, Bivol is somewhat susceptible to power, and I thought that would be the difference for Smith. It's unfortunate that he didn't have to board a guy, so Smith needs to go back to the drawing table. But I mean, one of the most curious things about this fight was the fact that prior to the fight, Bivol was just talking about going down to 168 to fight Callum Smith Jr., which I thought was weird because you got to fight right there in front of you. But I think Matt is definitely spot on. This guy has exceptional power and likely, in a sense, dodging the top part of the opposition. So, it's like I said, Bivol is a guy that does everything good but nothing necessarily great. And was he 16-0, 17-0, something like that, and still young in his career. So I think he got a title after only been 7-0 or something like that. He's been, in a sense, guarded from the top people at 175. So we will see.
Now the thing about him, possibly going down to 168. While that is like interesting that he would kind of like say that, but also, I mean, maybe he's saying that because he really doesn't have any other option there in the light heavyweight division. I mean, he's not going to be, unless if there's a way that he could fight a Marcus Brown, which he might not even want to fight Marcus Brown at light heavyweight. Maybe he just says, like, hey, he's kind of like, Contender trying to go down to 168 to fight a Callum Smith. But, hey, like Matt said, he might lose to Callum Smith. Shoot, I know Matt says he'd probably lose to Caleb Plant if they even tried to fight each other.
I just want to see what this guy's going to do, man. Like, he needs to give up his title because he doesn't sound like he's interested in fighting at 175. Now, the funny part is, I see a lot of excuses being made for him. Oh, he's a small light heavyweight. He's been fighting at light heavyweight since his career started. So don't make it seem like he just came up and weight and fighting all these big monsters. No, he's been fighting at light heavyweight for about 4 or 5 years. So this is his weight. If he wants to try to shrink himself down to maybe clean up a softer division, then say what it is. Don't make it seem like, well, he's small for the division. No, he's not. He's not small for the division. He's been in the division. He's won a title at the division. It's time to put up or shut up.
Yeah, that's the thing about it is that, like, he get. Remember, I mean, the thing is like he got the WBA title because it was vacated by Andre Ward there, and he ended up, beating Trent Broadhurst in like one round. And I'm like, people are like, who in the world is Trent Broadhurst? To kind of like have the WBA title on the line, between those guys. And, ever since, him getting that win over Broadhurst, it's kind of like being, okay, he has these fights against, Joe Smith, Sullivan Barrera, Isaac Chalimba. And it was like, Chalimba's way past it, Chalimba was way past it, and he couldn't, get through, go ahead and go through that guy. And John Pascal is way past it, and he couldn't get through, John Pascal. So, and here you have Joe Smith Jr., who's, has a had a record of 24-2, but it's like, well, he hadn't really done anything very impressively to like say that he's a serious contender to, be a world champion. And you can't, get guys like that out of there, and then you can't, you just can't be putting the likes, put up there in the likes of guys like better be a Kovalev and Gavazdik. Maybe, if they say that he could try to stay in that division, and maybe Anthony Yard could, try to sneak into those WBA rankings and get a shot, but I just don't see it there. Real quick, we're in there's like an overtime session in the live podcast here. Just wanted to get into that fight that's coming up March 16th, AT&T Center You got the IBF welterweight title on the line. Mikey Garcia going up against Errol Spence Jr. You know, Spence Jr. there, undefeated. Mikey Garcia, undefeated. Mikey Garcia is, you know, multi-division champion. Started, you know, started his career around featherweight and then moved his way, you know, on up. Featherweight, super featherweight, lightweight and super lightweight champion. Now he wants to see if he could become the IBF champion at welterweight against Errol Spence Jr. And this is, you know, something that he has been looking forward to since, you know, last year. He said that he wanted to fight Errol Spence to, you know, become a, you know, a big star in the sport of boxing. And so he says that this is his way to get there. But, you know, being a shorter guy and, you know, not really, you know, going up against the dog in Errol Spence Jr., this will be a very, very tough fight for him, you know, even with him having his brother as his trainer, who's one of the, you know, better trainers, you know, out there in the sport. But, you know, you could say that for Errol Spence as well. So, Matt, what do you think about it coming in?
Well, I think that it's going to be a good fight. I think a lot of people are underestimating Mikey Garcia. I do think Spence is going to win. I think Spence is going to end up stopping him in the mid to late rounds. But I think Mikey Garcia is really going to give a good account of himself. And I think anyone that's counting out Mikey Garcia, I think they're bugging out, because this guy is a champion boxer. There's nothing in the ring that he cannot do. And I think that if he says he sees something in Spence's game that he can exploit to carry him the victory, then I'm going to perk up and listen. And I want to see what he sees. So I can't wait for this one. I think it's going to be a very good fight. I think it's going to be a memorable fight. I think it might even end up being a classic fight. But that just remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think it, you know, just goes to the, you know, overall ability of Mikey Garcia. I mean, you know, Garcia is, you know, regarded as, you know, one of the best fighters in the game, pound for pound. And I think his, you know, overall skill and grit and, you know, ability to, you know, kind of like hurt opponents with both of his hands, kind of like gives him, you know, sort of a chance here in this fight against Errol Spence Jr. And, I mean, my other thing is that it's not like, you know, Errol Spence Jr. is the quote-unquote perfect fighter. You know, it's not like he's untouchable or anything like that. You know, we've seen that in, you know, his fights against Kell Brook and, you know, a couple of times against Peterson and things like that. So, it's not like he's going to just, you know, go right through him like that. So, you know, kind of like, you know, see it being a, you know, very competitive fight between two guys that are, you know, highly skilled there. So, I mean, I kind of like had that same expectation. Terrell, what are your thoughts on this upcoming fight?
Yeah, I think you guys know that Mikey Garcia has been one of my favorite fighters for quite some time. I was definitely at a loss for words when he elected to stay out of boxing for promotional issues, but nevertheless, the guy's back. And the main thing, he seeks and desires to be great. And nothing proves that by jumping two divisions and challenging what's called the purported beast at the class and going for his title belt. So, I mean, some of the things I thought about from this point, like we already just even discussed right here today. Obviously, Garcia sees something in Spence's style that they can exploit. And let's talk about some of the strengths of Garcia. Very sound technical boxer, power in both hands, like you look great. And the thing about it, what I like about him, he's always in position to punch, always in position to defend. Rarely we ever see him out of position in during the course of a fight. So, and just always in control, and giving going to the pace of fight, and can set the pace, can defend as well, things like that. So, when you break it down, one thing I thought about Garcia Happ in the build up to his fight and training for this fight. I don't know who his sparring partners was, but obviously, hope he brought in people that were larger than him, in order to so they can correctly guesstimate that size and that speed and someone imitates Pence. Not that there's anyone out there like Pence, but they definitely want to bring people in to imitate him, right? And also one thing to consider too, I think there's a rehydration clause on the day of the fight. I forgot what the weight, but they can't go past that weight, that number. That's mandated by the IBF. So that's kind of a note. So that means you won't see Spence coming there at 160, something like that. He'll probably come into the fight on day of the fight, probably around 54, 55, something like that, you know. Even with Garcia, you know, even at that size, his frame can only hold so much weight. So with that said, it's going to be very interesting to see how much he comes in on the day of the weigh-in. It's going to be at the limit at 147. How much muscle did he put on? Would he be able to still throw his punches correctly and move correctly in around the ring with that additional weight on? So all those things we need to look at, and we're waiting to see. But that's it. I really can't wait for this fight because once again, Garcia sees something that Spence that they feel like they can exploit. And it's possible. But I think Vegas has Spence at a 4-1 favorite on this fight. But once again, Garcia knows something that we don't know, and we're bound to see it. So I really, really can't wait to fight. And I hope it does be a classic. And with Spence, it's not like I don't like – I like Spence as a fighter. But in this fight, I just simply like Garcia. He's one of my favorite fighters for this generation, for this era right now. So hope that there's somehow, some way he can pull this off. Because that's going to give a lot of people a lot of stuff to talk about. And even what we spoke about before on the show, who has more to lose or who has more to gain, right? Obviously, if Spence were to lose his fight, he was definitely going to be exposed. If Garcia were to lose the fight and how he lost the fight, people are going to just naturally say, oh, he bit off more than he can chew. So with that said, I'm actually rooting for Garcia to take this fight. I don't see him knocking Spence out or even down. It's going to have to be a 12-round decision in the favor of Garcia. And once again, it's going to have to be completely and truly masterful for him to get jump up two classes and take that from Garcia. I'm sorry, Spence. And just one last note, too. We know that Garcia has display power at 30, 35, and even 140. And the classic question, does a guy bring his power up? And that's something that we'll definitely be waiting to see.
Yeah. I mean, my thing is with Mikey Garcia, he pretty much could go through all of this with, you know, little to no pressure at all, because he's not, you know, he's not favored to win. He's a much smaller guy. You know, he could, you know, come in there and, you know, if he wins, then, you know, he gets all the praise, like you said, but if he loses, he really doesn't, you know, have like a serious setback in his career. And he did bring up the whole thing about the rehydration clause. That's the, you know, IBF rule. So it's pretty much a 10-pound limit that they have in the second day weigh-in. So, you know, Spence can't be, you know, above 157 pounds going into the fight or the, you know, the night of the fight. So that's something that, you know, Mikey Garcia has to look out for there. But, you know, for me, I mean, I just kind of like to see the skill of Mikey Garcia giving him, you know, a little bit of a shot in this particular matchup. Mike Greedy, pitch in with your thoughts on it.
So Errol Spence versus Mikey Garcia. What are my thoughts on Errol Spence versus Mikey Garcia? I think what I hope to see is the fight will be similar to the Cale Brook fight in that Errol Spence will get tested, and I ain't gonna even lie, I want Errol Spence to win. But I will keep my reasons to myself. But yeah, I hope he gets tested. I hope that we find out a lot about.
Speak on it.
What's
speak
that?
On it. Why you want to win? Why you want him to win? Speak on it.
Oh, I'm good, Terry. I'm sorry. I don't want to say it. There's not like a it's not like a logical thought out reason. It's an impulsive reason, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure you know what it is. Sure you know what it is. I'll tell it to you in the group. I just don't want to say it on the air. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. I'm sure everybody get it, though. Okay, but so, yeah, I think that it'll be a fight where he gets tested, both guys get tested, obviously. And I'm hoping that just the fight that it takes both guys to places they've never been or never had to go to as of yet. And I hope we learn something about Errol Spence that will let me know whether or not he has that thing to beat Keith Thurman or that thing to beat, I guess Keith Thurman is the, I think he would beat Pacquiao off of sure, like, aggression and just, you know, in like, continued pressure and stuff. But, yeah, I want to see if he has that thing that will let me know how he'll do in the Keith Thurman fight. You know, like, I see Keith Thurman, and I saw Keith Thurman get hit with a body shot that 9 times out of 10, any other person probably would take a knee and wouldn't fight through the pain, like, mentally fight through the pain of, like, oh, this really hurts. Should I just, you know, take a knee and give myself a couple seconds? Like, Keith Thurman moved around the ring. Yes, he has deficiencies in that he needs to get his body together, do some more sit-ups and, you know, hit himself in the body with that medicine bag and stuff. But, you know, outside of that, outside of his physical deficiencies, which will be a problem again, I know that he has that thing within him that will, like, he'll pull down deep when he needs to. There was something that I feel like I learned about him in the Jose Cito Lopez fight, too. Oh, he got hurt in Jose Cito Lopez. Like, so we see many examples of him having to dig deep. I would like to see that in Errol Spence, and I think that Mikey Garcia should give us an opportunity to see that. This is the type of fight that may end up being like a tie or something just because both guys are, you know, pretty, their trajectory is a great trajectory. You know, like, you can't go wrong. Probably has a higher ceiling in terms of, like, monetary value, but and that may speak when it gets to a close decision. But in terms of both of their career and their trajectory, they're both on, like, a, you know, like, an accelerated, they're both elite fighters, I'll put it like that. And so I could see that being, like, it occurred to me during the Wilder and Fury fight that it could be a tie. But I was just hoping that, you know, in terms of, like, betting, it was either going to be a knockout or a Fury win. And I was like, you know what, there could be a tie. I should probably do this to hedge, you know, to hedge my bet, because I normally hedge bets anyway. But, yeah, so in this fight, I could also see a tie being a possible outcome. I mean, it's 3 outcomes, I think. Well, 4. I guess that's all outcomes there are, but 4 outcomes. Mikey Garcia decision, a tie, Errol Spence decision, or Errol Spence KO. Those are the 4 possible outcomes. I haven't done enough research on the fight to see which ones are the most likely outcomes, but I'll find that out, like, closer to the fight. Well, actually, the fight is, like, next week, so I need to start doing it. But, yeah, I think Errol Spence will win.
Well, let me ask you guys a question. How do you guys think this fight is going to do in terms of pay-per-view buys?
I'll buy the pay-per-view. That means that
it's
because
Fox,
you know,
pay-per-view. This is like the first one, isn't it?
Yeah, the first pay-per-view. So how many buys do you think we're looking at here?
probably below 100,000 or right at 100,000, if that, below it, but not probably right at or below 100,000.
Man.
My thing is that the thing with Mikey Garcia is that he's kind of like trying to bank on that he's, you know, a fairly popular guy in the sport of boxing, and I'm not necessarily sure that's the case. So, you know, him against Spence here, I don't think that the overall buys will be, you know, that much, man. I just don't see it. I mean, it's almost like, you know, I don't know if it'll be like Crawford Postal level or something like that, but it might be around that range. I wouldn't be surprised if it is around that range.
It'd be horrible.
It'd be like 50,000. It would be horrible, but I mean, I'm just not feeling like an overall, you know, overall anticipation about this fight, you know? So it's not like, oh, we got, a whole team of people that are behind, you know, Mikey Garcia to see if he could pull off the upset. I'm just not seeing it.
Yeah, but will the Mexican public buy a Mikey Garcia pay-per-view? Is he big with the Mexicans?
Yo, that was my thing, too. I was like, I don't know if the, you know, Mexican contingent would, you know, really be behind him like that. You know, I don't know about you, but I'm not seeing it.
I was hoping that the fight does 500K, but apparently I'm not even in the ballpark of what you guys think it's going to do.
Yeah, I mean, 500K, hey, if it does 500K, that would be, you know, to me, that would be a huge success, I would think, especially with it being, you know, a Fox type of telecast, but the thing about it is that, you know, they would hope that it would be like that because, you know, this is, you know, also, you know, like I said, with it being like a first Fox pay-per-view, you know, telecast, you know, this is like, you know, one of the first things where they kind of like put a lot of resources towards building the fight because you seem like, you know, those, the features on like Fox and FS1 and, you know, just going through, you know, what they were doing as far as like the press conferences and, you know, everything like that, you know, for this particular fight, that they invested some money into, you know, making this their first featured pay-per-view. So, you know, they would hope that they, you know, were able to get the returns on it that they really put into it. I mean, this is, you know, part of that money that, Fox threw at them for stuff like this to take place. So kind of like interested to see, you know, how it comes out as far as like, you know, overall viewership for this. But you know, I'm just not, you know, seeing it, you know, around social media that, you know, there's like that type of interest to where, you know, they would be very pressed to buy this particular fight. You know, pretty much, that was like kind of like what I was going to cover in this particular episode of the show. You do have, you know, also on Friday night, a fight card is at the Leocor Center where Tevin Farmer defends his super featherweight title against Joan O'Carroll, and Katie Taylor defends her unified titles against Rose Volante, and you got Gabe Rosado against Macy Selecki in that fight card over in Philadelphia. And hoping, you know, maybe trying to, you know, get myself up there for that fight card and to, like, kind of like see how that works out. Never really been to a fight card over in Philadelphia, and that's something that I pretty much want to see, like how the atmosphere is out there. So maybe stop by out there in Philadelphia on Friday to catch that fight card. But with that being said, that kind of like draws a close to this particular episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show. You catch the sister shows out here, the Cohort Truth on Sports. You have that on Tuesday nights. here on the Blog Talk Radio, but you can also catch podcasts of the Boxing Source Radio Show on Google Podcasts, on Spotify, on iTunes, and on Anchor.fm, amongst other things. And like I say, at the end of every show, the point of boxing is to hit, and I can hit, not the same in trade. On that note, I'm out. Have a good evening, everybody.
Bomb squad, baby.
Take something up and run with it.